This episode of The Sweaty Penguin is brought to you by Gummy Worms. Were you extremely influenced by the movie of everyone's childhood, How to Eat Fried Worms But Have Helicopter Parents? Try Gummy Worms today.
Welcome to episode 130 of The Sweaty Penguin, Antarctica's hottest podcast. I'm your host, Ethan Brown. I hope you all enjoyed your Thanksgiving holidays. Sorry that this episode is coming a little late. I'm dealing with a little bit of a cold, but hopefully you don't hear it too much in my voice today. Today we are talking about boats, which, contrary to popular belief, cannot be rowed merrily. I'm sorry, have you ever done crew? Or even tried the rowing machine at the gym for 4 seconds. I like to think of myself as a guy that looks for the fun in things, but even if you're going downstream, there is absolutely nothing merry about blasting your back, core, quads, hammies, glutes, traps, lats, and biceps while doing the toughest cardio imaginable, especially when it's always at 4 a.m. for some reason. Being the coxswain sounds fun, though. But beyond being a god-awful workout and home to the infamous poop cruise in 2013, boats are a really effective mode of shipping goods. Often described as the backbone of global trade, maritime shipping is responsible for the transport of the majority of raw materials, components, and finished products that facilitate and drive the global economy. That's right, that hemorrhoid cream you bought online from France last week grows the economy, baby. Although maritime shipping is a cornerstone mechanism that allows countries to receive essential goods such as oil, gas, electronics, appliances, and Barbie dream houses, it also has an interesting climate story. According to an article published by The Guardian, the maritime shipping industry accounts for roughly 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions, and earlier this year, those emissions were sprung into the limelight.
Now, maritime nations around the world have agreed to reduce emissions from the shipping industry to net zero by around 2050. The vague deadline announced at a meeting of the UN's International Maritime Organization in London apparently aims to take into account differences in national circumstances. The shipping industry currently accounts for around 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions, putting companies under increasing pressure to switch to greener fuels.
3%! You know it's bad when they don't even have a milk for it. As you can see from that clip, maritime shipping is in the news, and it's in the news because of its negative environmental impact. These loose shipping regulations agreed upon by the International Maritime Organization are one of the first widespread international agreements to try and address its climate impact, and it's led to a lot of controversy, with many saying the regulations don't have any teeth and are too vague and won't go far enough. It's like when you're a kid and your dad tells you to go to your room. Like, really? Did mom sign off on this? What's gonna happen if I don't? I wouldn't know. I was a flawless child. But on the flip side of those high numbers and vague regulations is the fact that really any other mode of transporting goods, planes, trains, automobiles, and all the ones John Candy didn't even think of, all of those have much higher emissions than a boat. And there's an interesting dilemma here. We want to make maritime shipping cleaner, but we also want to do it more. And as we'll explore today, there's a little thing called the Jones Act that is standing in the way of that. It's very quirky. It's like the Zooey Deschanel of laws, but instead of knitting sweaters, it was hurting the climate and costing Americans billions of dollars. So today, we'll discuss the pros and cons of maritime shipping, how the Jones Act has affected the industry, and what we can do to make maritime shipping as sustainable and effective as possible. If you want to take 2 minutes to help out the Sweaty Penguin, you can either leave us a 5-star rating and review, or join our Patreon at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. Doing either earns you a special shout-out at the end of the show. Joining the Patreon gets you merch, bonus content, and a whole lot more. But first, it's time for...
Boats! Boats! Boats!
I'm gonna say it. Ted and Becky should have dated longer. She wasn't the one for him, but he needed to feel needed. That was an important experience for him. Anyway, where were we? Right. Boats 101. Maritime shipping involves the transporting of goods by water. There are 6 types of maritime shipping vessels. The most common type is container ships, which are surprisingly not cruises for Tupperware. Though as Rose did say, a woman's heart is a Pyrex Freshlock plus glass storage with microban of secrets. A container ship carries all of its load in truck-size intermodal containers in a technique called... Ready for this? This is a really creative name. Containerization. Containerization makes it possible to keep better control of a large volume of cargo, which is why today, about 90% of non-bulk cargo worldwide is transported by container ship. Number 2 is a general cargo vessel. This type of vessel does not permit the use of containers, so the captain is strictly banned from Chinese takeout. Instead, general cargo vessels have their own cranes for loading and unloading items, and are mostly utilized to move dry cargo. Number 3 is a bulk container. Bulk containers are vessels that, you guessed it, carry a large quantity of items, such as minerals, fertilizers, or your mom. It is known for being a very versatile type of transport because it can deliver a large amount of goods from several different industries. Number 4 is a reefer vessel, which, as you can guess, delivers that sweet, sweet kush. Oh wait, sorry, I read that wrong. Reefer vessels are actually vessels with refrigeration capacity, making them ideal for transporting perishable food items. Since reefer vessels have to carry perishable foods, they actually move faster than any other type of vessel. They're also typically white, in order to reflect the sun's rays as much as possible to avoid overheating and spoiling the perishable items on board. The 5th type of vessel is known as a heavy lift cargo vessel. You got all these memorized? I will be canoeing to your house to quiz you after this. These vessels are designed for the transport of, can you guess it? Extremely heavy cargo! Okay, I feel like whoever named these vessels had 0 ounces of creativity left in their body. Just like me when I use this for another your mom joke. I didn't even make the joke, that's how lazy I'm getting. It's episode 130, cut me some slack. And the last type of maritime shipping vessel is known as the roll-on, roll-off vessel, or RoRo. Adorable nickname, right? Good for a boat or a baby niece. RoRo transports wheeled cargo like machinery, cars, and trucks, and is specifically designed to secure and repair these types of goods with professional immobilization elements. Perhaps Drake's brand new whip that got no keys came on one of those vessels. Now you may be wondering, why would a company choose to transport items using a boat as opposed to an airplane, truck, or train? Aside from the fact that it's arguably better to take a 5-night cruise to your destination as opposed to just flying there, maritime shipping has some real and valuable advantages. For one, ships can move a lot of stuff. Ships use a unit of measure called TEU, or 20-foot equivalent unit. One TEU is a container that is 20 feet long, 8 feet wide, and 8 feet tall, although on its tender it says it's 8'2". To help visualize, that's a touch bigger than the storage space in a 20-foot U-Haul, which is what you'd use to move a 3-bedroom apartment. And the average modern container ship can carry over 24,000 TEUs. That's about how much space you'd need to move everyone in the entire city of Scranton, Pennsylvania, if everyone lived in 3-person apartments. Maybe even less, given how small Michael Scott's plasma screen TV is. That really high capacity is a big advantage for maritime shipping. It also costs a lot less, around 4 to 6 times less expensive than air transport. And maritime shipping is really versatile, too. For example, when dealing with smaller shipments, you can arrange them in a group with other cargo, allowing for bulk cargoes to be able to fit into single containers. All of this is to say yay for maritime shipping. How else would your silly little purchases make it to your door so efficiently? Wait, hold on. My writers just told me you can buy a tank on Amazon. Is that true? Can someone look into that? I don't trust the comedy team. Another advantage of maritime shipping is the safety and security it offers when shipping hazardous materials. Transporting hazardous materials and dangerous cargo can be done more efficiently and effectively with maritime vessels because they are equipped with seals and locks that can keep dangerous cargo sedentary. We know that the Madagascar movies didn't do any favors for this. I was also upset that Ben Stiller wound up on an island off the coast of Africa because his shipping container was not secured properly. Wait, I'm getting word that Madagascar isn't about Ben Stiller in a lion fursuit. More on that later. And also, foreign trade and its long tradition in history stemmed from the inception of maritime transport, which helped connect international markets. But perhaps the most relevant to our discussion today is the fact that compared to other modes of shipping, maritime transport is the most climate friendly. It's truly the Lorax of moving cargo. That doesn't mean it's perfect, in fact, very far from it, as we'll discuss. But according to European Environment Agency data, maritime shipping emits 7 grams of carbon dioxide to move 1 ton of freight 1 kilometer. In contrast, trains would emit 24 grams, trucks would emit 137 grams, and airplanes would emit 1,036 grams. Now, I've seen slightly different numbers elsewhere, but wherever you look, maritime shipping is either comparable to rail or more often the far superior shipping choice when it comes to climate. It's worth noting, too, that planes release their emissions directly into the upper atmosphere, causing a greater impact on atmospheric chemistry than ship emissions. I mean, how obnoxious do you have to be to aim your emissions right at the upper atmosphere? At least be polite, maybe step out of the room or hide your emissions with a cough or something. That said, maritime shipping is far from perfect, and no, I'm not talking about the Guy Fieri lingerie sets I have to keep rebuying online. While maritime shipping is the least emitting mode of cargo transportation, it's also really far from perfect. It's like saying out of all of the 2010s sitcoms on CBS, The Big Bang Theory is the best. Like, sure, it beats Two Broke Girls, but that doesn't mean we should give it an award. Or, you know, 58 wins and 239 nominations. Meanwhile, The Good Place doesn't win a single Emmy. And Steve Carell never won an Emmy for Michael Scott on The Office. Hollywood is broken, guys. Anyway, where were we? Boats.
Boats! Boats! Boats!
Maritime shipping is responsible for 3% of all human emissions each year, including 9% of sulfur dioxide and 18% of nitrogen oxide emissions. According to a 2023 report from Ship It Zero that looked at contributions from major retailers, Walmart was the top ocean import polluter, responsible for 788,000 tons of carbon dioxide and 14.9 tons of methane, while Nike was the top ocean polluter of all fashion companies, responsible for 87,000 tons of carbon dioxide emissions. That is, if you want to classify Air Force Ones as fashionable. But to each their own. We have to be careful with this conversation, though, right? We definitely don't want to say, oh, you're bad because you use the most sustainable form of cargo shipping, but you do it a lot, so there's still a lot of emissions. It would be like yelling at Chobani for their yogurt being too high calorie. Like, I get it, you want a healthy snack, but it's food, it's gonna have calories. Unlike your organic, low-fat, low-taste yogurt, though, maritime shipping has a lot of inefficiencies, and that's why I bring this up. Most ships use some of the lowest grades of fuel, called bunker fuel or heavy fuel oil, which is a thick tar-like substance that comes from the byproducts of oil refining. It's really cheap, and it's really energy dense, but it also has an exceptionally high sulfur content, which can contribute to acid rain, and it creates black carbon, which amplifies global warming and darkens the surface of the Arctic. These pollutants also contribute to a wide array of health risks. What's more, these emissions are worsened by the lack of filters on the container ships. And I never thought I'd have something in common with a container ship, but I also lack a filter. You wouldn't be able to tell from our show, since... Another environmental issue from ships is oil spills. Anyone remember the Deepwater Horizon oil spill of 2010? Or perhaps you remember it by its pet name, the BP oil spill. Ah, the sweet nostalgia of the early 2000s. Oil spills are particularly damaging to environments such as beaches, mangroves, and wetlands. Whenever oil physically harms a plant or animal, it is referred to as fouling, which I presume is because it sounds really foul, or oiling. Oil can cover a bird's wings, making it unable to fly, and it can strip away insulating properties of a sea otter's fur, putting it at risk of hypothermia. Oil also contains many different toxic compounds. These toxic compounds can cause health problems such as heart disease, stunted growth, or death. This problem is being seen more and more frequently among cargo ships, but these oil spill incidents have primarily gone unpunished, sort of like Younger Siblings or Jerry Turner. The Bachelor really does remain undefeated in men making terrible decisions. It's as if having 24 women compete for your love turns you into a narcissist somehow. I don't get it. As cargo ships venture across the open waters, liquids collected from the engine room, oil detergents, water, and other substances collect in the bottom of the vessel, or the bilge. The bilge really sounds like the name of a nightclub on a cruise ship, right? Which, if all goes well, is also where substances will Like I said, I have no filter. This mixture of substances is referred to as bilge water, and it can contain chemicals, detergents, inorganic salts, and metals such as arsenic, lead, and mercury. Sounds like the world's worst soup. Maybe some croutons would help? These hazardous pollutants can severely damage the microorganisms on which larger animals feed and enter the human food chain via shellfish and fish. And according to an investigation from DW, the amount of oily water dumped into the oceans via cargo ships could amount to more than 52.8 million gallons a year, or roughly 5 times the equivalent of the 1989 Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. DW was also able to pinpoint more than 1,500 potential illegal dumps that occurred around the world from July 2020 through December 2021. These mind-boggling discoveries exemplify how vulnerable marine flora and fauna are, and how nations who are dependent on fisheries as their main source of financial prosperity and stability are bearing the burden. And the pollution issues don't stop there. According to a 2021 Environment International study, all vessels from a sailing boat to a cruise liner release substantial amounts of metals such as copper, zinc, and nickel, which then accumulate in the ocean sediments. Copper can be found in anti-fouling paints that coat the hull to ensure barnacles and other marine organisms that slow down the boat aren't becoming encrusted. Why no one's invented anti-fouling paint for men who don't shower and become encrusted is beyond me. Zinc can be found in the metal blocks attached beneath the waterline of the boats. Their role is to protect the hull from corrosion. Finally, diesel-powered ships have scrubbers attached to them to reduce the emissions of harmful gases into the atmosphere, but they have inadvertently caused high concentrations of nickel to be present in wastewater discharges as a result of the exhaust gas cleaning process. This pollution is really difficult to track and seems to get in the way of some otherwise solid ideas to make ships more sustainable. One last issue that's a bit more unique to maritime shipping is the issue of container ships striking marine animals. And no, I don't mean protesting marine animals to get better wages and worker protections. To be fair, these AI porpoises are like 5 years from taking everyone's ocean jobs. In episode 124 of the podcast, we discussed how the North Atlantic right whale population has become endangered due to boat strikes and fishing gear entanglements, The same can be said for whale sharks. A 2022 Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences study unveiled that cargo ships are likely a leading cause of whale shark deaths. This was determined by the authors analyzing where the highest densities of whale sharks in shipping traffic are found. It turns out they are found in the same area. Statistically, more than 90% of the ocean's surface area that whale sharks use overlaps with the routes of tankers, passenger ships, and fishing vessels. Whale sharks swimming near the Gulf of Mexico, Arabian Gulf, and Red Sea were discovered to be at the greatest risk of collision. Besides whale sharks, ships are hitting smaller sea animals more often as well. Researchers have scoured necropsy results and other anecdotal worldwide data, concluding that at least 75 species are affected, including dolphins, sharks, sea otters, seals, sea turtles, and get this, penguins. You thought sweaty penguin was bad, try flattened penguin. Those feet aren't so happy anymore, are they? Those species also include the endangered Kemp's Ridley sea turtle and Hector's dolphin. And trust me, Hector is not happy about this. Factors that affect these species' vulnerability include their age, younger animals can be playful, less experienced, and assume the best in a cargo ship, and their sleeping habits, species that spend large amounts of time sleeping near the surface or take naps after lunch. Again, I don't say all this to say boats bad. In fact, boat's good, assuming I have my motion sickness wristband on. But a lot of these problems are fixable. And since maritime shipping does account for 3% of human emissions, it's absolutely worth fixing them. It's like Taylor saying, "It's me, hi, I'm the problem, it's me." Like, girl, we can all work on our flaws, but you are a queen and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Some say I talk about her too much on here, but I don't think I talk about her enough, to be honest. Here's the other problem, though. If maritime shipping is already the most sustainable and has all this potential to improve, we should be doing that as much as possible, right? Well, unfortunately, we don't, and there's a big reason why. You might be wondering where on earth our expert interview is this week, and it's because in that interview, we talked pretty much exclusively about a very specific thing, the Jones Act. Our guest this week is Dr. Russell Hilberry, Associate Professor of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University. Here's Dr. Hilberry with a little bit on what the Jones Act is all about.
So the Jones Act is more than 100 years old now. It was passed right after the First World War. And the objective, the sort of principal objective, advertised objective, was that the U.S. retain kind of merchant marine capacity, ability to produce ships, to man them, and just be able to operate. And that was seen as a kind of defense. It was important for national defense to have that kind of capacity. And so that was the reason the law was originally put in place. Like a lot of restrictions on international trade, it's not clear that that was the best way to maintain the capacity that they are trying to achieve. And I think, I'm not a sort of defense expert. I'm just studying the economic consequences, but it seems that the domestic shipbuilding capacity is basically withered away. Is not kind of competitive on a global market. And so it doesn't seem that the act is achieving its military objective or defense objective. And so anyway, that law has been in place for more than 100 years. There are shipbuilders, ship owners, crew members, all who have kind of interest in maintaining the law, because probably if the law was removed, then they aren't competitive with international shipping, and so shipping or shipbuilding, and so there's kind of resistance to changing the law that comes from the interests of those individuals and firms, But in general, I think you wouldn't, if you had a dispassionate view, you probably wouldn't see this as a policy success.
The Jones Act, surprisingly, is not the law that says James Earl Jones must play Mufasa in the Lion King reboot, but none of the rest of the original cast can participate. Don't get me wrong, Billy Eichner was amazing, but Nathan Lane is a national treasure and Disney needs to apologize. In reality, the Jones Act, or the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, is a federal law regulating cabotage, or naval transport in U.S. coastal waters and between domestic ports, as well as other aspects of the maritime industry. And I must say, cabotage sounds a lot more sinister than it is. I would have thought cabotage is what it's called when restaurants give you coleslaw. Like, come on, Raising Cane's, do you really think I came here for cabbage covered in mayonnaise? Under the Jones Act, cabotage from one U.S. port to another is only allowed if the ship was built in the U.S., flagged in the U.S., and manned by an American crew. The idea was to assist American shipyards and maritime fleet by eliminating competition from other countries and protect national security. Unfortunately, that doesn't really work so well. Constructing and building a container ship in the U.S. costs up to 5 times as much as it does abroad, and transporting crude oil on a Jones Act tanker can cost 3 times as much. Alexa, play Price Tag by Jesse J featuring B.O.B. Actually, don't. And because of that cost, only about 2% of all U.S. freight is carried by ships. And despite the massive growth in coastal U.S. cities since the 1960s, coastwise shipping tonnage has actually declined by roughly 44% over the same period. In fact, the U.S. possesses 0 Jones Act-compliant liquefied natural gas tankers, which makes it nearly impossible to transport LNG in bulk to New England and Puerto Rico, presenting a major energy security issue. And since maritime shipping is a much less carbon-intensive mode of transportation than airplanes or trucks or Battlestar Galactica, I'm assuming, haven't watched it, the Jones Act has created not just an economic dilemma, but a climate dilemma, too. Think back to those numbers from earlier. Maritime shipping emits 7 grams of carbon dioxide to move 1 ton of freight 1 kilometer, trains emit 24 grams, trucks emit 137 grams, and airplanes emit 1,036 grams. These are big, big differences. They're as different as Joe Alwyn and Travis Kelce. I'm telling you, one Taylor reference an episode is not enough. We need to be having these conversations. And if high costs forced by the Jones Act have hampered maritime shipping to the point that only 2% of U.S. freight is carried by ships, that means we are emitting a massive amount of carbon via planes, trains, and automobiles that is completely unnecessary. The other big climate problem is that the Jones Act has absolutely crushed the American offshore wind industry, which in addition to being a cheap and reliable source of energy, is a really valuable way to reduce carbon emissions. I'm not saying offshore wind doesn't have problems, though, like Brittany Mahomes, some of the problems are complete misconceptions. I encourage you to check out our whales episode, where we talked about the lack of evidence for offshore wind affecting them. But whether you love or hate offshore wind, I think you'll agree on the absurdity of the Jones Act in this industry. I actually didn't realize this, but there are only 2 operational utility-scale offshore wind farms in the United States, one in Virginia and one in Rhode Island. That's right, we have the same number of offshore wind farms as we do Disney theme parks. Why so few? Well, the offshore wind industry uses big specialized ships to assemble the turbines miles out at sea. But there is not a single U.S.-flagged ship right now that can do that work. To install the Virginia wind farm, Dominion Energy had to ferry parts back and forth from Canada to avoid running afoul of the Jones Act. And for the Rhode Island wind farm, they used a Norwegian ship, sent it to France to pick up generators, and then brought it to the U.S. to do the installation. Which is absolutely mind-boggling. It's like having to do your grocery shopping in Canada because the only U.S. supermarket is out of shopping carts. In fact, this dilemma has led the U.S. to actually lag behind the rest of the world in knowledge on how to install offshore wind, which is really concerning. I mean, I knew we lagged behind the world in reading and math, but offshore wind installations too? Now, in 2020, Dominion Energy basically said enough is enough and forked over the dough to build the first Jones Act-compliant vessel to install offshore wind turbines. But that vessel is running them $500 million. That's more than the net worths of Vin Diesel, both Chainsmokers, and Kenny G combined. That should tell you how lucrative offshore wind is if Dominion Energy, a fossil fuel company, is going to those lengths to pursue it. But there is literally zero reason, aside from the Jones Act, that offshore wind would require this level of upfront investment. It's worth noting that the offshore oil and gas industry has faced similar barriers, but I think it's unlikely that offered any climate benefit. If anything, it would lead to more foreign oil and gas that has the same climate impact and is just unnecessarily expensive. So how big is this cost discrepancy between American ships and foreign ships if it's leading us to fly cargo on airplanes and ferry wind turbine parts back and forth to Canada? Well, in 2013, the shipping company Matson ordered two container ships from the shipyard for $209 million each. In 2022, Matson ordered three of the same ships from the same company for roughly $333 million each. Cue up Jesse J again, folks, because that is quite the price tag. But the cost to build a similar vessel in a foreign shipyard is about $30 million, less than a tenth of that. Because American shipyards are averaging only three ocean-going ships per year, high fixed costs are being spread across the fewer vessels, which limits volume discounts from suppliers, specialization, and economies of scale. It's like throwing a massive birthday party for your kid. Sure, renting the clown was expensive, but the more kids you invite, the less terrifying the clown cost per kid becomes. One clown can entertain three kids or 30 kids, just like one boat-making machine can make three boats or 30 boats. I assume boat-making machine is the technical name for them. Do you, like, press a button? You get the idea. And due to these high costs of producing container ships, the majority of U.S. container ships are also older and not as technologically advanced because they're so unnecessarily expensive to replace. The average age of a Jones Act ship in 2019 was 20 years old, more than 7 years older than ships that don't meet the law's requirements. That's right, the average Jones Act ship can boat, buy a car, serve on a jury, and even sneak into some bars and casinos without getting carded. Furthermore, the previous 15 Jones Act ships that were scrapped had an average age of 43 years old. And I'm all for using everything to the end of its life. I have plenty of underwear and pajama shirts with holes in them. But even I can acknowledge it's not a good idea to use ships until they reach menopause. The economically useful life of a ship is 20 years, but 3 of every 4 U.S. container ships are more than 20 years old, and 65% are more than 30 years old. Minus tankers, these ships in the Jones Act fleet are 11 years older than the average age of a ship in the world merchant fleet of other developed countries. Now, these costs affect all of us. It makes any goods transported between U.S. ports more expensive. Not to mention impacts on climate change, energy security, and all that. But some places are hit harder than others. Dr. Hilberry co-authored a paper specifically examining the costs of the Jones Act on Puerto Rico, where maritime shipping is really, really important. Here's Dr. Hilberry sharing a bit about the study.
We found in the study that the products that were most affected were what we call final products. Products that are purchased primarily by consumers, but it could also be purchased by governments or firms. But they're not intermediate inputs. There's more to say about intermediate inputs. We'll come back to that, I hope. But the kind of final products, the products that you and I consume, as well as, you know, fire engines, which the government buys, right, are products that seem to be most affected in this analysis that we study. And so we figure out how much reduction in trade there was And then we ask, okay, what kind of trade costs would have to be associated with the Jones Act in order to get Puerto Rican importers to behave that way? And so we estimate that kind of gap. We call it a tariff equivalent. What if it were a tariff on the U.S. imports from the U.S.? And then we ask, okay, now suppose that tariff is what's causing this behavior, then what does that imply about the additional costs of the Jones Act on the Puerto Rican buyers? And so we estimate that overall final expenditures by citizens, by governments, and to some degree by firms, those would be about about $1.4 billion lower per year than they would be without the Jones Act, according to our estimates. A large part of that falls on households because they're buying a large part of these final goods. And their expenditure is about $691 million. It costs them $691 million. And that ends up to be about $203 per Puerto Rican citizen per year. So that is our kind of headline number of what is the cost of the Jones Act.
$203 per person per year. That's like a whole salted caramel cold brew at Starbucks. Dr. Hilberry's discoveries are eye-opening to say the least, even more eye-opening than my salted caramel cold brew at Starbucks. In fact, these costs are so high that it can force Puerto Rico into some really weird situations.
We've just looked at, okay, you know, the people in Puerto Rico are buying potatoes. And we've been in the supermarket in Puerto Rico, and the potatoes that they buy are from Canada, not from the United States, right? So, you know, so we're just trying to look at those sorts of substitutions where here's a heavy product and heavy in the sense of low value relative to its weight. And Puerto Rican consumers are buying a foreign source rather than a domestic source. And these kind of tools that have been developed in the last 15 or 20 years in my discipline allow us or give us a framework for putting a kind of a tariff estimate on there. Now, I think it's quite probable that these restrictions have affected the industrial composition of Puerto Rico. You know, one example is that there isn't much agriculture done in Puerto Rico. And, in particular, when there used to be a lot of sugar production and now there's not sugar production, I think a lot of agricultural inputs would rely on fertilizers, for example, which would be heavy and which would be coming from the United States often. And it just isn't economical to buy those fertilizers and apply them in Puerto Rico, for example.
It's true. The Jones Act wrecked a whole industry in Puerto Rico because they couldn't get fertilizer, and they have to get their potatoes from Canada, which is really concerning because the only potatoes in Canada are covered in cheese curds and gravy. And trust me, I love poutine, but it's gonna get a little soggy on its voyage from Quebec. But Puerto Rico isn't the only region to be disproportionately burdened. Take Hawaii, where the greeting aloha simultaneously means hello, goodbye, and I'm a tourist who doesn't know if this outfit is cultural appropriation or not. Since Hawaii is a group of islands and relies on maritime shipping for nearly everything, the Jones Act is pretty consequential for the state economy. The Grassroots Institute of Hawaii released a report in July 2020 seeking to quantify the costs of the Jones Act to the state, and the findings were really concerning. Looking at vehicle expenses, it costs an additional $4.3 to $9.7 million per year for cars sold in the state than it would if they could be shipped from domestic ports using market rate services. Gasoline is between $19.1 and $55.2 million more expensive due to the Jones Act, and even repair services are as much as $12.7 million greater because of the added shipping costs. Looking at real estate and construction services, the Jones Act currently adds between $54.4 and $255.9 million in annual costs, and in fact, it usually ends up being cheaper to import sand, cement, gypsum, steel, and bricks from foreign countries and pay tariffs than it does to just comply with the Jones Act, hurting not just Hawaiians, but also producers of these materials on the mainland. Annual costs for retail stores on the island average about $54.3 million higher because of Jones Act restrictions, which will hopefully prevent tourists from buying problematic hula girl bobbleheads, but otherwise is far from ideal. And when you put all that and more together, the Jones Act costs the average Hawaii family $1,794 a year. Hawaii is the state with the highest cost of living in the country, and these Jones Act restrictions certainly seem to be playing a role in that challenge. And then there's Alaska, the only state where bear jam is a traffic report and not just a weird toast topping. When the Jones Act was passed in 1920, Alaska was not a state yet. It was a very different time. The Ottoman Empire had fallen only 12 years prior, water skiing was 2 years away from being invented, and get this, it wasn't illegal to send your kid as a large parcel via the U.S. Postal Service. To be clear, you didn't have to put your kid in a box, but you did have to put postage on your kid. Really gives a whole new perspective on your package getting lost in the mail. But while that was legal, the Jones Act made it illegal to not just ship between domestic ports with a foreign ship, but to go through Canada to Alaska ports with a foreign ship. In fact, the act specifically reads that states did not have to follow Jones Act restrictions when they were traversing Canadian waterways or rail lines unless it was going to Alaska. Alaska, who did not have a vote in Congress at the time, took this to the Supreme Court as a discriminatory policy, and they lost because since they were a territory, federal policies were allowed to discriminate against them. It's kind of giving Regina George, to be honest. Wesley Jones, the senator for whom the act is named, was from Washington State, so he essentially wanted to prevent Alaska from importing via Canada so that everything would go through Seattle. This imposed a massive cost on Alaska commerce, even causing once profitable businesses to have to shut down. Once Alaska became a state in 1959, that provision was changed to allow Alaska to partake, but the problems did not go away. Various government reports in the 1980s found the Jones Act cost Alaska's oil industry about $225 million per year, the timber industry $4.77 million per year, and God knows how many more Life Below Zero episodes we could have. I mean, 22 seasons is nowhere near enough. And the workaround to pass ships through Canada has barely been utilized, due in part to political pressure from Jones Act proponents. In the early 1980s, for example, a company attempting to offer service between Alaska and the lower 48 using Canadian railroads and West German-flagged ships was stymied by the U.S. Federal Railroad Administration. You might even say it was railroaded. I'm a little too proud of that one. But as it turns out, the FRA got in the way because once again, the senators from Washington State pushed to block it. And if that wasn't enough, later, another Washington congressman actually got a bill passed in the House to repeal that exception altogether, though it didn't make it through the Senate. And these fights have not gone away. Just 2 years ago, U.S. Customs and Border Protection slapped a $350 million fine on Alaska's pollock industry for what they alleged to be violations of the Jones Act, though it's not even clear if it is a violation because part of the route went through Canada, and that's literally the exception. It's like when you learn the rule I before E except after C, and then you try to spell the word science. Prior to that $350 million fine, the largest Jones Act fine in history was $10 million, and as I'm sure you can guess, that one also involved Alaska. Forcing the Alaskan pollock industry to change their route would nearly double their transportation costs, another massive blow for what is considered by many metrics to be the weakest state economy in the country. And as climate change worsens, these concerns only intensify. For example, in 2017 and 2022, Hurricanes Maria and Fiona respectively hit Puerto Rico. As we've covered on the podcast, these storms claimed many lives and led to catastrophic damage, recovery from which is ongoing to this day. But during both of these hurricanes, more than 99% of the world's cargo ships couldn't immediately participate in the relief efforts because they didn't comply with the Jones Act. In fact, after Fiona hit last year, there was a tanker moving diesel from Texas to Amsterdam that got rerouted to Puerto Rico to boost the island's depleted fuel supply. But because of the Jones Act, the ship wasn't allowed to offload. The diesel had to just sit on the docks while the captain said, "The gate should be ready for us any minute. Please keep your seatbelts on and tray tables stowed in the upright and locked position." After a massive public outcry, the Department of Homeland Security eventually issued a Jones Act waiver, and the diesel was offloaded, I'm guessing really quickly before DHS could change their mind. But while we won the battle in that case, we badly lost the war. A few months after the Fiona situation, the 4,300-page 2023 National Defense Authorization Act passed the House 329-101 and the Senate 86-11. I didn't think that many congresspeople agreed on one page of stuff, let alone 4,300. Hopefully banning splitting the check at birthday dinners was somewhere in there. But buried in this piece of legislation was a new rule that prohibits waivers for vessels already carrying cargo, as well as a requirement that waivers be granted no earlier than 48 hours after a waiver request is published. In other words, a vast bipartisan majority moved to prevent a waiver like the one that diverted critically needed diesel to Puerto Rico during Fiona from ever happening again. Of all things, to bring the policymakers of this country together, blocking diesel from reaching a hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico is a really, really weird hill to die on. And sadly, this is far from an isolated incident.
So I think it's quite telling and supportive of our hypothesis that that was the most important thing to get to Puerto Rico at that time, was something that essentially the U.S. ships for carrying those fuels are few and far between. And responses to disasters are inhibited by the Jones Act. Almost every time there is a tornado hitting Puerto Rico, I would guess the Virgin Islands as well, there's this kind of debate, should we waive the Jones Act? Often that waiver arrives, but you know, it takes some time to do that. And I think in this case, they set sail and you know, the waiver process happened while the ship was on the sea, you know, so they're kind of, this is becoming normal that there will be a waiver in emergency situation. But it, you know, it's something where if you could just divert a ship that would otherwise have been taking fuel to Jamaica or something, then it would be rather much simpler. And bringing the other supplies, that ship was I think only about this fuel. But there would be other supplies that you need in a disaster, and there was only the one waiver, as far as I was aware.
And unfortunately, the Jones Act isn't the only challenge facing the maritime shipping industry in a changing climate. Via thermal expansion and melting glaciers, climate change contributes to sea level rise, and sea level rise is heavily impacting seaports. That, coupled with intensifying extreme winds, floods, and tsunamis, are disrupting loading and discharging operations, resulting in delays for owners, charterers, and customers. Furthermore, the melting of Arctic ice, caused by climate change, not because you left your freezer door open overnight, looks to transform international shipping routes. In some ways, that's a good thing. These faster trade routes would make maritime shipping cheaper and reduce carbon emissions. But there are concerns too, specifically the fact that Russia has exerted significant control over these emerging Arctic routes. I'd encourage you to listen to episode 122 on the Bovanyenkovo gas field to learn more about that, but in short, utilizing the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, Russia has been able to regulate maritime traffic through the Northern Sea Route, requiring vessels to be piloted by Russians, provide advance notice, and pay tolls, presumably with a boat easy pass. Maybe since you get motion sick on boats, we can call it a queasy pass. With the Russia-Ukraine conflict escalating, These Russian impositions have intensified, affecting global shipping dynamics and exacerbating the vulnerability of countries dependent on maritime exports like Ukraine. The situation has escalated to the point where Russian and Iranian vessels are increasingly going dark, turning off their location systems and adding a layer of unpredictability and concern in international waters, which is essentially the equivalent of someone turning their Snapchat map ghost mode. You're my friend. All I'm asking for is a live feed of your exact whereabouts at all times. Is that so hard? Obviously, that's not to say Russia owns the Arctic Ocean and will run the show forever. They only have so much power here. But given the amount of effort they've put into militarizing the region, it is a bit concerning to think climate change will divert more maritime vessels into their jurisdiction. Are we doomed? Is the maritime shipping industry on the brink of destruction? Of course not. This is 2023, not Pompeii before the Big Bang. Wait, that's not what the Big Bang was? I meant the volcano, sorry. In our next segment, we'll discuss how shipping can be more sustainable, how to deal with this Jones Act thing, and when we can start sending kids in the mail again. I mean, really, what kind of parent are you if your kid doesn't have a UPS tracking number? Let's bring that back.
Do you want to go back to the simpler times of when man would once scavenge for their own food? Then gummy worms are for you. Sure, you'd have to scavenge at your local Walmart, and if you wanted to keep true to the essence of man, you would have to steal them. And stealing is a crime, but do you want to be in touch with the core of the human race or not? Gummy worms. Send your bail to the writer of childhood classic, How to Eat Fried Worms.
So where do we go from here? How do we get all our little treats and goodies from around the world as sustainably as possible? Well, before we get too into it, I want to first address where there is a bit of an upward climb. As I mentioned in the intro, to try to combat emissions from maritime shipping, the UN developed a climate target for the global shipping industry earlier this year. The agreement set a decarbonization deadline for, quote, by and around close to 2050. And let me tell you, that's about the vaguest deadline I've ever heard. That's like my friend inviting me to their party that will start around 8-ish, and then I show up at 11 and people are just starting to trickle in. Obviously, that's a joke. I don't get invited to parties. But I get why people are concerned about that new UN target. There is nothing fashionably late about climate action. And furthermore, the plan sets benchmarks of 20% reductions by 2030 and 70% reductions by 2040, both of which are not quick enough to comply with the 1.5 degrees Celsius global climate threshold. Now, I'm not saying baby steps aren't helpful. This is certainly better than nothing. But it's a little bizarre to make a plan that's not in line with your ultimate goal. It's like how my goal is to meet a nice girl and live happily ever after, and my plan is to sit on my couch every night watching football highlights. Furthermore, if we successfully get some cargo off of planes and trucks and onto boats, that helps the climate too, but would technically lead to more emissions from the maritime shipping sector specifically, and that needs to be taken into account too. So that's the first uphill climb. The plan in place is not actually in line with global climate targets. The other uphill climb here in the United States is that despite all the roasting I did of the Jones Act, it has a seemingly unshakable degree of political support. According to Dr. Hilberry, that tends to be due to concern about American shipbuilders going out of business.
So this in international trade, it's often the case that industries that would not be able to compete with imports are sort of adamant opponents of some liberalization of this kind. And so I don't think it's unusual that the producer interests, be they capital or labor or the upstream shipbuilders, they're no different than the steel industry that wants tariffs on imports of steel. And so in that context, they can roll out arguments about the loss of American jobs or, this sort of thing. those would probably be temporary, and there aren't so many jobs at stake. I think that the primary economic arguments would be that there are incumbents who would suffer. And, in these debates, one reason we felt it was important to write the paper, in these debates, it's kind of forgotten that the consumers in Puerto Rico are paying this cost. And consumers in Hawaii and Alaska, et cetera. So it's important to have numbers about how much the consumers pay for this.
And I get it. I don't want to see American businesses go out of business either. Unless, of course, we're talking about United Airlines. Seriously, the only thing anyone's united about is not wanting you to exist anymore. To me, it seems better for the U.S. economy if all these other industries relying on maritime shipping don't get harmed by this regulation, and if American shipbuilders can't compete, at least there will now be plenty of opportunities to get jobs elsewhere. The other argument is a national security one. We can't become dependent on other countries to ship critical goods for us. And again, I get that too. However, I would think if we buy a ship from another country, it's our ship, we can have American crews, we can use it for a couple decades, and I don't think there's much risk relying on very strong allies like Japan and South Korea for those initial purchases. But that view is not a common one in US politics, and it seems lobbying is a big reason why. To give you a taste, in the first quarter of 2019 alone, the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations spent $262,200 on lobbying activities, including on the Jones Act. The Marine Engineers Beneficial Association also spent a record high $837,000 in 2018 on Jones Act lobbying. That same year, American Maritime Partnership paid $960,000 to K&L Gates for lobbying, including on the Jones Act, and Saltchuk Resources reported spending $290,000 that year on lobbying related to seaports such as the Jones Act. These special interests may help explain why, even in Alaska and Hawaii, it is rare to find national politicians vocally opposed to the Jones Act. It's even harder than finding politicians opposed to puppies in costumes. I'm not saying we have to repeal it. I'm also not saying that. But I am saying it's a bit of an upward climb when a law with this many economic justice and climate issues has this much bipartisan support. All that said, there are certainly a lot of options for how we move forward. And when there are a lot of options, it's hard for me not to be excited. It's like when you're on a road trip, ready for dinner, and you see the next exit has a Chili's, an Outback, and a Buffalo Wild Wings. Like, there is no going wrong there. Starting with making maritime shipping itself more sustainable, one option is promoting the adoption of enforceable speed limits, especially in areas that have high levels of marine animal ship strikes or endangered species. That's right, giant maritime ships can have speed limits. They can also have P limits if you give an immature pilot a can of white spray paint. Honestly, such an underrated joke. That's the one vandalism I support. According to a 2006 Marine Mammal Science study, the chance that a cargo ship will kill a whale falls to below 50% when it's moving at around half speed, or 10 knots, compared to nearly 100% when it's moving more quickly. And to be clear, a knot is about 1.15 miles per hour, not the thing that comes untied on your shoe every time you're in a rush to get somewhere. Furthermore, having slower ship speeds decreases greenhouse gas emissions, reduces air pollution, saves money on fuel consumption, and increases the safety of workers on board. Those environmental benefits and cost savings are actually more pronounced than you may think. As a ship moves faster, drag increases rapidly. Drag is a force on a solid object moving through a liquid fluid, and the more drag you have, the more expensive and emitting the ship's journey becomes. In other words, it is not a drag race. I'm just saying, you don't want your boat to be the queen of drag. Sorry, it was right there. Obviously, there is a cost with going slower too. we may not be able to get our online deliveries as quickly, and companies will have to invest a lot more money into inventory since it'll take longer for stuff to arrive. But ultimately, if these costs of traveling fast can get passed on to the companies and the consumers, it may incentivize more people to take it slow. Just don't tell Taylor and Travis that. They're shacking up in Kansas City, and besides the fact that I may have to play against him in the fantasy football championships, and he always plays a million times better when she's at the games, I could not be more excited about this. Another option is better navigation systems. And no, I don't just mean switching your GPS to the Australian voice. Although I do think that would help. I mean, come on. Better navigation systems could help vessels avoid hazardous locations, find key fishing areas, track animal migrations to reduce close contact, and even reduce time at sea. That's worrying to me. I mean, how are they going to come up with all the sea shanties now? But perhaps a price worth paying. Another avenue could be developing and providing sensors that could be used to collect ocean data. If ships automatically gather water samples, they can provide real-time monitoring and chemistry testing to help scientists on land bridge the gaps and strengthen their knowledge about ocean conditions, currents, changing temperatures, and acidification. The Ocean Foundation also suggested creating a GPS network that allows ships to tag large accumulations of microplastic, ghost fishing gear, and marine debris. I'm not sure if you can add them as a collaborator yet, but at least if you tag them, it'll be on their wall, doing it 2015 Facebook style. These tags can then be accessed by governmental or non-governmental organizations who can then collect the debris. Another idea, which I personally love, is wind kites. Yes, kites! Maybe not the pretty kind with flowers and butterflies on them, but we'll work on that. Wind kites have demonstrated an incredible capacity to tow massive cargo vessels weighing up to 165,000 tons without the need for any fuel. By harnessing the potent force of high winds, wind kites have the power to replace conventional bunker fuel. For example, France created a kite system they call the Sea Wing, which surprisingly isn't the name of the Seattle Seahawks mascot. Really missed your opportunity on that one, Seattle. This 5,400 square foot kite system is mounted on multi-million dollar cargo ships and has reduced fuel consumption by 20%. The system operates by deploying the kite as the ship enters international waters. This deployment leverages optimal wind altitudes and patterns, allowing the kite to efficiently tow the vessel forward. Shipowners can also install Flettner rotor sails, which cuts fuel consumption by more than 8%, and air lubrication systems, which cuts fuel consumption by another 12%. Although these systems have proven to be effective, they do have an upfront cost, which could explain why they haven't been installed in more than a handful of the world's 60,000 commercial vessels. But that's where governments could come in and offer tax breaks, grants, loans, or other incentives to take that step. Besides, a high upfront cost never stops me from putting things on my credit card because credit card money isn't real, so I suggest shipbuilders do the same. My comedy writers have told me this is something called girl math, and it's 100% effective. How about policy? There have been a couple proposals put forth by the US government. For example, earlier this year, a federal bill was introduced called the Clean Shipping Act that, if passed, would set emission standards for shipping companies that dock at American ports, requiring them to align with a pathway toward net zero by 2040. Another law proposed earlier this year was the International Maritime Pollution Accountability Act, which would place a pollution fee on large ships unloading cargo at U.S. ports. Obviously, these are very top-down approaches, so totally reasonable to like these ideas or not like them, sort of like how it's totally reasonable to like or not like toilet paper rolled under. I'm sorry, I guess I prefer it over, but I really don't understand why people have such strong opinions about this. Either is fine. There are absolutely alternatives to heavy regulations, though. There can be tax cuts for companies that invest in efficiency gains, there can be a Cheesecake Factory gift card for whichever boat is the most sustainable. There are so many different ideas that could help nudge along these various solutions. And then there's the elephant in the room, Jumbo. Jumbo, get out. We're trying to do a podcast. Sorry about that. Now that the elephant is gone, let's talk about the Jones Act. One option is, of course, to repeal the Jones Act. In 2021, two senators actually introduced the Open America's Waters Act, which would do just that and allow all qualified vessels to engage in domestic trade between U.S. ports. And obviously, that could resolve a lot of the issues we've discussed today. However, it would also be a very drastic change. Dr. Hilberry pointed out some of the reasons why one could argue a full repeal might not be as practical as it sounds.
So I think if we eliminated it altogether, I mean, I don't think it's sort of practical to eliminate it altogether. I don't think there will be Filipino crews on barges going down the Mississippi, and I don't think that the political system would sort of allow that level of penetration of foreign competition into all of these areas. But if we reached a level where, you know, it disappeared completely, then, there's a lot of domestic sailors, you might call them, who have jobs because of the Jones Act, that pilot U.S. ships and crew U.S. ships for various different activities. And so, those job losses would be, I don't know if they would be immediate, but they would be coming, right? Then there are a number of firms that are specialized in providing transport within the U.S. In Puerto Rico, there are four firms that do most of the transport with the U.S. And, it's unlikely they would survive, uninhibited competition from the rest of the world. There's just too much opportunity for a European ship to just go down the U.S. coast, pick up goods and drop it off in Puerto Rico and go home, or something a lot like that. So I just think those companies would probably go under or really kind of downsize their activities. And then the shipbuilders would sort of also, it's not clear that they're competitive at all with foreign shipbuilders. So I think those are the stakeholders, and they all reasonably worry about import competition because it's pretty certain that they wouldn't be able to compete.
If repealing the Jones Act were on the table, all of this would be really important to consider. Domestic crews, domestic shipbuilders, and the firms they belong to would all take a serious hit, and just because a controversial law protected them for a century doesn't mean we shouldn't care what happens to them. It's like when your mom repeals bedtime. Sure, it was an unfair rule, but we still care when you stay up watching Vanderpump Rules reruns until 3 a.m. on a school night. That's not to say we couldn't repeal the Jones Act. That's an option for sure. But there are other options, too, that might not quite as drastically pull the rug out from under people. What would that look like? As opposed to gutting the Jones Act, policymakers could look into reforming and amending current statutes and stipulations. These reforms could look like eliminating or modifying the U.S. build requirement for cargo vessels, exempting Alaska, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico from the law, relaxing foreign crew restrictions, or allowing for limited cabotage rights and international cargo relay. Call me Malcolm, baby, because we're meeting in the middle. Life is unfair. Another idea is for all energy shipments to be exempted from the Jones Act, or even a specific waiver for renewable energy projects. To increase the likelihood of this passing, some have suggested a sunset provision that would repeal the amendment after a fixed date, with the intent of allowing the offshore wind industry enough time to mature, but increasing demand for U.S.-built installation vessels, since there would be a ticking clock on the foreign vessels. I propose Congress send a text to a girl they like and issue the waiver for as long as it takes for her to write back. If they're anything like me, that should give them a solid 30 years or so, and I think that's a good amount of time. Could these reforms get done? I don't think we fully know. As Dr. Hilberry said, a lot of this is less of a how-to-do-it question and more of a political will question.
I mean, I think it's largely a political question. And I there are people in Washington who say we should get rid of the Jones Act, and so far they've been wildly unsuccessful. It can be that political circumstances can change. But I guess, you know, it may also be that there be some kind of half steps towards getting rid of the Jones Act, right? So it isn't clear that, as I kind of feel that the domestic build requirement is particularly not very well supported, that these ships have to be built in the United States. If we want to have ships that serve a certain purpose, we can certainly go out and buy those ships from, let's say, South Korea. You know, we don't need to necessarily build them ourselves. And that could be very different from the idea that, okay, we need domestic crews or we need domestically owned services that do this work. But also, I think that's also inefficient to sort of assume that there have to be domestic providers of all of these services. But I think we can go a long way towards addressing this problem by relaxing the domestic build requirement, that the ship be built inside the United States.
I know it's overwhelming when the cleanest form of shipping goods has a law that drastically limits it in the United States, and it has an environmental impact of its own to boot. But there are so many ideas to help maritime shipping take off and reach its full potential. If we can reform or repeal the Jones Act and incentivize some of these cleaner technologies, we can improve the climate, economy, and ensure you can mail your kid via boat rather than a U.S. postal truck. This wraps up episode 130 of The Sweaty Penguin. Take 2 minutes, help out the show, and get a shout-out at the end of the show by leaving a 5-star rating and a review on Apple or Podcast Addict, or join our Patreon at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. You get merch, bonus content, and more. Clips today came from DW News. Special thanks to our Emperor Penguin patrons, Lawrence Harris and Brownie Central. Thank you all for listening, and I'll see you probably sooner than next week to give a little preview of the COP28 conference that has started in Dubai and talk about some arguments that may come up in light of that. So I will see you then. Though, as Rose did say, a woman's heart is a Pyrex flesh... Pyrex Fresh Lock Plus Glass Storage with Microban. Pyrex Fresh Lock Plus Glass Storage with Microban. Pyrex Fresh Lock Plus Glass Storage with Microban of Secrets. Thank you.